possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Our topic today in this portion of the program, American innovation. Innovation differs from invention. An innovator takes an idea, an invention, and runs with it, putting it to work. Our guest today, historian and journalist Harold Evans. He is the author of They Made America, From the Steam Engine to the Search Engine, Two Centuries of Innovators. It was the basis of the PBS documentary series of the same name that aired on our companion station, WILL-TV, last November. In the introduction to They Made America, Mr. Evans describes many of this country's innovators as democratizers who, quoting here, made it possible for the whole population to enjoy goods and services previously available only to the elite. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Harold Evans has had a long and distinguished career in journalism and publishing. He is editor-at-large of The Week magazine and a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report. Prior to moving to the U.S., he was the editor of The Sunday Times and The Times. His books include War Stories, Reporting in the Time of Conflict from the Crimea to Iraq, and The American Century. He is a recipient of many honors, including the British Press's Lifetime Achievement Award. Last year, he was honored with a knighthood in the Queen's 2004 New Year's Honors List for services to journalism. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Sir Harold Evans, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
A pleasure, Celeste.
As I mentioned in my introduction, you say many of the people that you profile in They Made America were democratizers. Now, I hadn't thought of it that way. I hadn't thought of inventors and innovators like that before. When did you make that realization?
Well, when I saw how many of the innovators, and as you rightly pointed out, they're distinct from inventors, innovators who brought to the mass of people what had previously been available only to the well-off. Now, in Illinois, for instance, Sam Insull, whose reputation, as I think, been wrongly smirched, he brought electricity to the masses by finding a way in which over one decade, then another, he could bring the price of electricity down. So the Midwest, in particular, enjoyed 30% cheaper electricity than New York. So Sam Insull was a democratizer. Take another one, Henry Ford. Until Henry Ford came along, cars were undoubtedly for one class only, the rich. Woodrow Wilson, the president, declaimed against the rich driving their cars over the poor people and killing them in great quantities. And actually, of course, Ford, if he'd stayed with his company instead of leaving, it became Cadillac. But he came to the Model T Ford, a great democratizer. Give you one another example. For instance, when you go to the ATM today or you go and get a mortgage, it just seems natural, this kind of thing anybody could do. But that wasn't so until a man called A.P. Giannini came along, an Italian immigrant. Actually, he traveled across America in the womb of his mother on the first transcontinental railway trains. he came to San Francisco, and a long story, his father was murdered, he inherited nothing, his mother was a widow, he was an orphan, and but he gradually got a tiny seat on a seat on a tiny bank in Sacramento, and was appalled that they would only lend money to people who didn't need it. They wouldn't lend money to average people. So he introduced popular banking. We will lend money to anybody on the strength of their character rather than on the size of their bank balance. And this became, it grew and grew and grew, this idea of popular banking, this democratization of his. And that today is the Bank of America, the largest bank in the world, started with a handful of customers in Sacramento on the vision, on the democratizing vision of one Italian immigrant.
Yeah. Now, Mr. Giannini and Mr. Insel, these are men that before picking up They Made America, I had never heard of before.
Well, you're not alone, because one of the impulses, Celeste, driving me to spend 5 years to write this book was the realization that many millions of Americans don't know where their benefits came from. And I think it's a great tragedy that while we read hundreds of thousands of millions of words about political leaders, and I've written quite a few myself in my book, The American Century, we never are told, even at school, about these lesser-known innovators. Now, everybody's heard of Henry Ford, but not many have heard of Insel, or for that matter, Leo Baekeland, or again, just to give you another more recent example, Herbert Boyer, who gave us biotech, artificial insulin, and things like that. So it's about time in the States, and I'm now an American citizen, so I can say this with a certain freedom rather than as an outside observer critical. It's about time we started celebrating the innovators who've improved our lives rather than those people who've simply entertained us.
Why has America seen so many innovators in the course of our relatively brief history?
Well, I think one thing, I personally, when I first came to Illinois in the 50s and lived on a calm farm downstate with the Gum family, the quality of the light always made me feel optimistic. It's much lighter and brighter. That, of course, is a kind of facetious, if you like, but it was real to me. And secondly, the fact that immigrants come here bringing not just their muscle and sometimes their brilliance, but also a gene for risk-taking. They've already risked a lot by leaving their homeland, and I think they see society differently. And then I think, thirdly, America's always been a very pragmatic peoples. When the first people were moving west, one of the great things they did was to experiment with different kinds of windmills to raise water. And I was always been impressed by American fascination with gadgetry and inventions that would make life simpler. And I think that that pragmatism was really born in the country from the early struggles to survive. You had to innovate to survive, whether you were a settler in Virginia in the early days at Jamestown or a settler on the Western Plains or on the Great Desert. We had always to be innovating. And I think also, and this is important, because while I don't think you can understand America simply by looking at political history, you simply cannot, the point about the political framework in America is freedom. It's somewhat hackneyed, maybe, as a word, but it's real as a concept, because unless you're free, unless individuals are free, unless individuals are also free to acquire a very good education than we may have, you're not going to see much progress. And everybody goes on about China today. I think China's not going to make the great leap forward until the people there have been freed from a totalitarian system.
Well, they're certainly, it seems to me that they're certainly on their way to doing that, around the edges, anyway.
Well, they're on the, tell you know, Celeste, I think they're becoming, they're a great producing country. I'm not going to embarrass you or me by saying, let's try and identify 10 things the Chinese have innovated in the last 30 years, because I can't think of any. Whereas what have we come up with? We've come up with cell phones that take photographs, which they didn't, but actually they do. We've come up with FM, you know, all sorts of innovations keep coming out of America. And, you know, some of them are more important than others. I mean, but I think, for instance, that Raymond Damadian, who found a way to take pictures of the inside of the human body with an MRI machine, a great benefactor. And all these people, by the way, even though America is receptive to innovation, everybody, almost everybody in my book, has had to struggle. I mean, Damadian had his phone cut off at the university. The Cancer Institute stopped money going to him. He had to raise the money to make the first MRI machine by collecting dimes from children in Long Island. So we have some way to go before we always embrace the innovators.
Hmm. Thinking back to what you said a moment ago about risk and pragmatism, at the outset of They Made America, you tell a story about visiting Jamestown, Virginia, years ago and marveling at the innovativeness of the settlers. Tell us what they did. They made good use of things they brought with them from England. They brought them for one reason, but turned up they needed them and they used them for something else entirely.
When the first settlers arrived, after the lost colony in Virginia and the first settlers were at Jamestown, they always expected the Spaniards to come and kick them out. There were only 100 of them in any event in Virginia. And they brought breastplates and rapiers and little iron balls with spikes in them to throw in the Spanish cavalry path. When the Spanish didn't come, they couldn't think of much use for the iron balls, although I did see them unearth ivory chessmen in Jamestown. But what they did with the breastplates was turn them into cooking utensils. Innovation. Innovation.
Yeah. I mean,
and you go through early America, you find that happening time and time again. And naturally innovative peoples. As I say, you know, even the first settlers, of course, were immigrants. And although immigrants are normally thought of as bringing muscle and sometimes problems into the country, actually they do bring this different perception, which enables them to feel free to say, why don't we do something this way rather than that way? If you take some of the people in my book, for instance, the man who gave us plastics was a cobbler in Belgium as a kid, until he came to America and invented plastics. It's all very well to say, oh, who likes plastics? But actually, that led to the first self-starter in a car because it was perfect material to withstand the heat of a car. And Kettering, who invented the first self-starter, couldn't do it until Bakelin gave us plastics. So there are many. One of these innovations builds on another. When you get a man called Louis Tappan in New York, a shopkeeper who recruited Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses Grant basically to spy on people all over the country to say whether they were creditworthy, which was actually sounds a very malign idea, but in fact without establishing a good system of credit, trade could not expand because there wasn't enough gold to support it. There was no paper money at that time, no federal paper money after the Civil War. And so Louis Tappan established credit rating, which is today Dun and Bradstreet. He was an ardent abolitionist, by the way, against slavery, and that's why he had to start giving credit because the South boycotted his stores. So again, innovation springing naturally. And then Cyrus McCormick. When Cyrus McCormick, the great, great man in my judgment, brings in the Reaper, not only does he free labor for the Industrial Revolution and for the Union Army and the Civil War, but actually he invents something more important than the Reaper, which is credit, higher purchase. He enables a farmer to bring in his harvest with the Reaper, which he's not yet paid for. Until McCormick came on, you had to have brought in the harvest before you could pay for the Reaper, but you couldn't bring in enough of the harvest to pay for the Reaper, therefore you didn't have a Reaper. So you see the way these things build on each other. So somebody like Cyrus McCormick, incidentally, you know, somewhat of a stingy individual in terms of his personal habits, was nonetheless a real revolutionary force in the United States. And as I say, his innovation freed labor for the Industrial Revolution, for people like Sam Colt's factories, for, you know, all the many developments that occurred in the Industrial Revolution in America.
Hmm. Sir Harold Hebbins is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's a historian and journalist. He is the author of They Made America, From the Steam Engine to the Search Engine, Two Centuries of Innovators. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You've found in studying these men and women that making money has not been the sustaining motivation for most. What has motivated innovators in our history?
Well, it's a very, very good question, though, because these lives are very dramatic, very romantic, and they're far too often seen simply as people assembling a fortune. Some of them did, some of them didn't. But what drove them was never, in my judgment, except possibly in out of four or five, what drove them was a desire to achieve something. Now, vanity comes into it, intellectual vanity. I must solve this problem. Thomas Edison wanted to solve the problem of the incandescent light bulb. Altruism drove some of them. Giannini, for instance, whom I've mentioned, popular banking, would never, ever take the money that was due to him. He would say, no man owns a fortune, it owns him. So he renounced the wealth that accreted to him as the founder of popular banking. Time and time again, they were driven by a sense of wanting to benefit mankind. I know that sounds a little naive, a little romantic, but you cannot study the lives of the innovators without being impressed by how much they were driven by wanting to be remembered as a significant person. Now, call it vanity, call it altruism. Some of them, I have to say, were very much moved by religion. Do not let us underestimate that. I mean, Samuel Morse, for instance, was highly religious, moved by religious feelings. So was Cyrus McCormick. So was Theodore Judah, the Transcontinental Railway architect. And many of them had these, what we would call, high motives of virtue. And I have a theory now emerging from this book, which I can't necessarily prove immediately, which is the terrible scandals that we get in business. I know it's a small minority, really, but the scandals we get are when managers and owners think only of money, and then there's no inhibition on what shortcut you can take, what trick you can get up to. Whereas if you're trying to solve an intellectual problem, a shortcut or an intellectual trick is self-defeating. You're not going to solve the problem of radio circuitry by taking shortcuts. Edwin Armstrong had to solve the problem. Incidentally, he became rich, and incidentally, he got in terrible battles with commercial corporations that wanted to suppress his innovation of FM radio. But nonetheless, it was the fact that he was driving towards a specific goal, which was not money-making. So I would say to all businesses, actually, you're going to succeed the more you'll keep your eyes on serving the people. And, of course, one great thing about that is that if you don't, normally, competition will force you to. And we have to be very careful not to allow monopolies to develop.
We've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us this afternoon. We're going to go first to a listener in Belgium, Illinois. Line 4, go ahead.
Yes, a couple of points. The first one about Mr. Giannini. I thought he was actually from San Francisco, but I could be wrong. Matter of fact, he played a very pivotal role during the earthquake and subsequent fire in San Francisco, where he saved a large amount of money by carrying it away in a carriage. But the point I really wanted to point out was that Mr. McCormick and Mr. Deere, who did do very, very good things for farming and the mechanization of such, their abilities were preceded by someone lost in history who developed barbed wire, which tamed the prairie fire, which was a very serious problem for the development of farming, because they took and put fences around to eat the grass, to keep it far enough away to plow the ground, to make the crops grow.
That's quite true. All what you say is correct. He arrived first in the San Fresno Valley. He actually, San Francisco is where the bank was. Thank you for that, with Giannini. I've dealt with Giannini at great length in my book. In the earthquake, what happened was that he went down to his bank in San Francisco and put the specie gold, such as it was, behind a pile of oranges and drove them away to avoid being taken up by looters. And then he opened up a bank on the wharf on a plank across two barrels. So that was quite so. The point about barbed wire, I've written about the West in my book, The American Century, and you, of course you're right in the sense that barbed wire enabled people to command land more than the 160 acres allowed by the Homestead Act. But the reaper could have still been used even on the wide open prairies. You know, I mean, I don't think that the reaper is necessarily tied to the invention of barbed wire. But anyway, that's by the by. I mean, McCormick was there had been a reaper before him. The interesting thing about McCormick is that even though he wasn't by any means the first to invent a reaper, a man called Obed Hussey, who put out a reaper before him, put out an imperfect one, and McCormick insisted on spending several years perfecting his reaper.
I was just pointing out the fact that you couldn't really have a farm at all as long as the prairie fires were kept burning your crops year after year.
Yeah. Well, are you a farmer? Because it sounds like you might know something about farming.
I've been related to him a lot. But the problem was that the animals ate the grass, which also gave them income.
Yes.
And allowed them enough room to break the sod and become farms, because before that, the fires would just take over the crops and the houses and everything else.
But I'm sorry to have to refer you back to, but I did write about this in the American Century, and I'm on all fours with you. I've spent a long time on discovering what happened in the drive west after 1890, when the years of the open range were over. And with them, the long drive to the cow towns and the roundup over thousands of square miles. That was ended in about 1890. Anyway, that's very interesting commentary there altogether. You know, the farmer's barbed wire was the enemy of the cowboy and the big ranchers.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, it was very much on the side of the farmers, who could then manage their cattle.
Right. Let's talk with another listener. I want to thank our caller in Belgium for joining us this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener in Indiana, line one. Hi.
Hello. I guess what I'm interested in is if you could give some talk about finding some of these people. Now, some of the people, like McCormick, I remember seeing him in a fifth or sixth grade book, you know, and standing in front of a reaper, McCormick's reaper and stuff. And, of course, some of the other people, but first person you mentioned, that fellow who started the more popular form of installment buying, I never heard of him at all. And I was wondering how you went about discovering these people in particular. Just, you know, for my own interest to try to do it, particularly now that we got the web. But, you know, it's sort of frustrating sometimes when you hear about people you didn't know anything about, and since their outcome is extremely important, so I'm coming in it from that angle. Thanks a lot.
Well, that's a very good point to make there. Well, actually, I had a grant from the Sloan Foundation for Technology, which enabled me to engage a researcher, and so the two of us spent a whole year going through archives and histories, and I had help from two professors at MIT and one from Yale. And between us all, we drew up a list of about nearly 500 people who made genuine innovations, which is more than an invention. I mean, something which created virtually a new industry. And many of them were unknown. I was just as surprised as anybody when I came across Louis Tappan. There's a very, very good, actually, book about him, but now. So these excited me because here they were, having made great discoveries. And if one types in Louis Tappan on Google today, I'll be interested to see what you get. describe him in the book. But other people you type in onto Google or wherever, you will get very few. And some you will get, for Henry Ford, you will get a fantastic number. But for these other people, you don't. So one of the I'm still glad you asked this question, because one of the points about my book was to get away from the standard textbooks where they deal with Robert Fulton as the inventor of the steamboat, which he was not, because John Fitch preceded him with the steamboat service, and to put McCormick as in the context not simply of an inventor of an agricultural machine, but the creator of a social system, so that you've put your finger on something pretty important here. And I think I'm hoping that attention will be paid to these unknowns, because they exemplify many of the great strengths of America, and to ignore them is a great injustice. I've included in the book, incidentally, another man relatively unknown, Gary Kildall, who gave us the operating system of the computer, which was basically pirated from him and ended up with Bill Gates.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit more about him, and then maybe you'd tell us a little bit about the two fellows behind Google.
Oh, yes. Well, the Gary Kildall was an absolutely brilliant computer writer. He was a writer of code. They call them Mozart of code writing. And in the 70s, he produced the first software code writing which would enable any application, word processing, accounting, whatever, to operate on any piece of hardware. He was the father of the software industry. And so the whole generation of software began to be possible thanks to Kildall. And Kildall, when IBM came to look for a operating system for a PC, Bill Gates did not have one. IBM, for one reason or another, which I've gone into great detail, couldn't reach an understanding initially with Kildall, so they went back to Gates, who bought a pirated version, virtually identical system of Kildall's, and he sold that to IBM, and that's how he became the richest man in the world. In the meantime, Gary Kildall was betrayed, because IBM said they would put out his system at the same price, but they didn't. They put it out much more expensive because they had to pay Kildall less. It's a long story and a kind of tragic one, but Kildall, who gave us so much, certainly should be remembered. And incidentally, he was against any operating system owner having control of applications, because he said it would be a dangerous monopoly. Now, coming back to Larry Page and Sergey Brin, they really are an amazing pair, really. Both of them young men, born in the early 70s, both of them, and get together at the university and figure out, which I've described in the book, how they can apply a mathematical system invented by a Russian, which is not commonly known. It is called the Markov chain equation, which tries to account for several things: the number of pages linking to a certain web page, the number of pages leading out of that page, and the chance that someone surfing the web would not always jump directly from one page to another link to it, but may begin on a completely new web page. And all this information is boiled down in a formula, which I printed in my book, but a couple of essential details are missing because they keep them secret. And once they'd got that to that stage of doing this, it's really amazing. They bought as many possible computers as they could to scan the web, and take a picture as they trawl the web, and then take more and more pictures with more and more computers. And it's quite interesting how they were turned down initially by one of the major Silicon Valley people. They hoped to license their system in return for money to continue research without abandoning their PhD studies at Stanford. And so, as they say, they spent a lot of time talking to people in, like, Excite and InfoSeek, trying to convince them that they had invented a technology that was in the foreground, but nobody would engage with them. And the crunch came when the CEO of a major search company said that search didn't matter to him that much. He said, our search is 85% as good as the next engine, and that's good enough for us. Well, that company's now out of business. And they talked to their friend from Stanford, Yahoo founder David Filer, who told them, when it's fully developed and scalable, let's talk then. And it's very interesting. So many of these innovators, including these two, face rejection and dismissal. And they all face failure of some kind or other early on. And one of the problems we have in America today, Celeste, and anybody else who's listening, is that Wall Street today and the media is far too much of a hurry for quick short-term profits, and therefore innovators tend not to be backed for as long as they could. Fortunately, with Google and Brin, they did find support, and of course they had a public offer, and they're now billionaires, and pretty well everybody now uses Google. But it's the same with so many of these people. They face initially skepticism, then rejection, that when they get acceptance and capital, they then find failure, and then they have to be sustained through failure. Well, Edison said it best. He says, you don't learn anything unless you fail. Learning is the process of failing and learning from it.
That's very interesting that you mentioned Edison, because in your profile of him, there are a number of things that I found very interesting. The invention factory, how he put all that together. And also, and I'll ask you to comment here in a moment, but allow me one more observation. His education. His education had been anything but ideal, but then, as you observe, some of his breakthroughs came from very wild ideas that people who were educated would have just said, no, that will never work.
That's very important. Education is important, but it sometimes can be a straitjacket. And the truly educated man can break out of his education and challenge his own assumptions. Edwin Armstrong, who gave us radio, said that one of the major problems, who gave us FM radio in particular, one of the problems was that we make so many assumptions. And Josh Billings said, it ain't ignorance that causes all the problems in the world. It's things people believe that ain't so. And Henry Ford used to say, don't tell me something's impossible. I want to challenge that assumption. So that's very, very important. And now Edison used to say that the school teaching of ABC meant anything but creative. In fact, of course, he didn't have a proper education, and he was a genius. There's no question that Edison was a genius. Most of us are better off clinging to the education we have. But the genius who comes along without an education or who challenges his education is ipso facto a genius, because the accreted wisdom in the textbooks is wisdom. 90% of the time, it's that 10% that makes the difference. I don't want to come out anti-education. I think we need science education, etc., technical education, and so on. But we do have to understand that the genius is somebody who's going to throw it all over. Henry Ford didn't have much of an education. He grew up mainly on, you know, homespun truisms given to him by his mother. Incidentally, when you asked about money before, Henry Ford says, thinking about money is destructive because it takes your mind off what you should really be thinking of, which is solving the problem.
Thomas Edison thought of money, though.
Well, he did. He needed money. What he thought of money, not for personal enrichment. He thought of money because he needed it to employ inventors in his invention factory at Menlo Park, or Camelot, as I call it. That's what he wanted money for, to be able to sustain. Robert Fulton, however, originated the first successful steamboat service. No, not the first steamboat service. He was in debt so much of his life and always sponging off friends that he really was moved a lot by money, because he hated the thought of having to go back begging again. And, of course, John Fitch, who gave us the very first steamboat service, could never get enough money to keep the thing going. And he was there, by the way, was a man who wanted to be remembered as a great man rather than to become rich.
Back to Thomas Edison, if I might, for a moment.
Certainly.
I want you to tell this story because you are a journalist. You've been a journalist all your life. If I'm remembering correctly, your first job as a reporter was at the age of 16.
Yes.
So let's talk about Thomas Edison and what might have been the world's first newspaper train.
Ah, yes.
I love that story.
Edison got a job as a boy selling peanuts and apples on the train. He actually then showed the mark of an incipient capitalist by getting other boys to help him. And he started printing a newspaper on the train. And the great breakthrough for him was the day that he used to go into the newspaper office. I'm trying to just to recreate this for people. He's up and down, and he's on the way from where was he? Where was
Michigan?
He?
And he would quite cheekily he would go into the Detroit Free Press every day.
That's right, Detroit Free Press, and also into the public library, where he tried to understand some of the science and found some of the mathematics, and found it impossible. So Edison, he's got this little job, and his father's encouraged him to get it, and he has the idea that he'll, print copies of it was called the Detroit Free Press was where he got the papers from. His own paper was called the Herald, and it was a 3-hour journey from Detroit, and on that layover, he'd read in the Detroit Public Library. Found it too difficult. In his Weekly Herald, he handset on the train 24 issues of this sheet of local news, and he got 500 subscriptions. Yeah, 500 subscriptions from passengers at 8 cents a time. And one day, he walked into the Detroit Free Press composing room and saw a headline for tomorrow's paper. It was in April 1862, and it was a headline reporting the Battle of Shiloh, where many thousands had died. I think maybe as many as 30 or 40,000 Americans had died at Shiloh. He could only buy 300 papers to sell on the train. He wanted more, and he was told to go away. And there's a famous American journalist called Wilbur F. Story, whom I've mentioned in one of my other books. And Edison broke through to him and said, let me have 1,000 copies on credit. Credit comes back again. He'd already bribed the officials at the railroad office to telegraph the fact that there'd been a battle at Shiloh. And so once he got the papers, he was mobbed at every stop he went along the way. By the time he reached the end of the journey, one newspaper was fetching $150. And that was, it's very important you raise that, Celeste, because that was the moment when he decided to be a telegraph operator, because he realized how important it was to annihilate distance and time.
Yeah, very interesting.
The first, the train newspaper, arising out of initiative, his interest in news. And he didn't say, the paper he sold on the train was the Detroit Free Press, not the Weekly Herald, but he'd already had built up his reputation for this little sheet. What an amazing man, Edison. What an amazing man. I mean, but I can fault him in a few things. He was too resistant to Westinghouse over alternating current. He wasn't the greatest of husbands. I tell the story of how he used to work so late in his invention factory one night when his wife had gone to bed and locked the doors. He climbed in through the upstairs window and found himself looking at a Smith & Wesson 38. She thought he was a burglar. Thank heavens she didn't pull the trigger. if she'd pulled the trigger, we wouldn't have had the world's first power station in Pearl Street. We'd have had to wait several more years for the incandescent light bulb. We might never have got the phonograph within that decade.
Oh, interesting. Harold Evans, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of, among many books, They Made America, From the Steam Engine to the Search Engine, Two Centuries of Innovators. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we've got a few minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, you're invited to do so. The telephone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. At the end of the introduction of They Made America, you Note that the long worldwide supremacy of American innovation is being challenged as never before. Where are the world's innovators coming from today?
Well, they'll come from Europe, and where they're going to be, I can't predict. One of the interesting things about innovations is that the big ones are never predicted, and they take us by surprise. So I'm often asked, what's next? And the honest answer is, I don't know. And all the innovators I speak to, they're cautious too. As I said, I don't think it will come out of China. Something might come out of Japan, where they're doing more research. I think that Europe is the more, apart from America, Europe is the most likely. For instance, when you go on the computer, you use a language access to it invented by an Englishman called Timothy Berners-Lee, who now is working at MIT. I mean, that was a fantastic innovation, which didn't arise out of America. It came out of an Englishman who was then working in Switzerland at the time he formulated this. And now, as I say, he's working here. So it can come. You know, it's staring you in the face. There's probably, if you look out of your radio station today, there's probably an innovation you should see immediately. But you can't, probably, and I can't, certainly. For instance, just think of the innovation of the little yellow post-it you stick on the refrigerator.
Yes.
Obvious. Or think of when I went back to England in the 50s, I was impressed by the grocery supermarkets here. I thought I'll start a supermarket in England. I never did. Of course, I was in journalism. But it never occurred to me then that to have the innovation of a supermarket for office products, Staples, Office Depot. And look at how long it took for container shipping to arrive. In the 30s, a North Carolina trucker impatiently waiting to load cotton bales onto a big ship had to wait all day, and he thought it much simpler if I could drive my truck onto the ship, Malcolm McLean.
Yeah.
But he didn't, and it was 25 years later, no container shipping, he suddenly decided to take up that idea, take the wheels off a truck, and have it lifted onto a ship. That has transformed the world. And yet that innovation was staring everybody in the face. And nobody thought about it. I mean, there's been a little bit of experiment here and there, but basically Malcolm McLean brought to fruition an idea he had 2 decades before. And in those 2 decades, nobody else brought it up. It's the same today. There's an innovation, rather than an invention, an innovation as simple as that, putting 2 or 3 things together, waiting to be discovered. And one of your listeners, I will give a bottle of champagne when they come up with it.
Let's talk with one of our listeners. Listener in Champagne, line 1. Good afternoon.
Hello, Mr. Evans. I've enjoyed
how'd you do that?
Hearing you speak this afternoon. And I was just wondering, since we were in Champaign-Urbana here, I was wondering if you discuss at all in your book John Bardeen, who is, of course, well-known here at this university, but maybe some of the people listening don't know what he did and his involvement in sort of modern computing, and I wonder if you had anything to say about him.
Oh, I do, indeed. In fact, he's a hero. I mean, in fact, I begin my section on the digital age by describing that day in December 23rd, 1947, when John Bardeen and Walter Brattain actually gave us the transistor. And, of course, as we know, William Shockley came along and improved it. But nonetheless, that brilliant day in December 1947, when they managed to amplify voices in the Bell Lab, is very, very important. And, of course, I pay tribute to Bardeen and to Brattain, who were perfect collaborators in understanding that electricity could travel through all parts of the block of germanium in the same way. Bardeen had the hunch that electrons behaved differently on the surface of the metal, and Brattain, the experimenter, proved him right. And that's a marvelous collaboration, and that's the beginning of the digital age. Of course, another man one should mention in the digital age is Claude Shannon, who died in 2001, who actually wrote the paper which inspired people to think in terms of noughts and ones, Boolean algebraic formulas, which gave us the digital age. And he was working for the Bell Labs, too.
Yeah. I'm sorry we have to wrap up now. We're out of time.
Thank you, Celeste.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you. And I just want to say to our listeners this afternoon, there is such a diversity of people in this book, They Made America. There are 70 in-depth profiles of innovators and then short takes on 101 others, and we have only just scratched the surface here this afternoon. And pictures. Oh, that's something I wanted to ask you about, but I can't because we're out of time. But the layout of the book is beautiful, and I expect that also owes to your experience as a journalist and an editor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you to the listeners who called
in. They Made America, From the Steam Engine to the Search Engine, Two Centuries of Innovators, authored by our guest this afternoon, Harold Evans. The book is published by Little Brown. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade today, new contract lows made in almost all, and I mean this, all of the bean contracts. The only one that didn't make a new contract low today, the August, and it settled down 3 cents at $5.17. Let's take a look, before we get to those numbers, at the Chicago Board of Trade soft red winter wheat futures contracts for the day. The March contract, a 294 for the wheat, high or and the low at 290.5, and a settlement price there at $2.92.25. They were up 1.25. The May futures up 2 cents, 301.75 the high, the low at 98.25. That's $2.98.25 a bushel, and a settlement price right at $3, just $3.75. They were up 2 for the day on the May wheat. July futures now 308.5 high, low at 305.25, settled 307.25. They were up 1.75. In the September futures, 313.5 high, low at 312, settlement price at $3.13 up 2. And the December future, 323 the high, the low at 320, settlement price at $3.20.25. They were up 0.25 for the day. March corn, $1.98.25 the high, the low at $1.97, settlement price at $1.97. Unchanged for the day, the May contract, 206 the high, the low at 204.75, the settlement price at 204.75. They were up 0.25. The July futures, 213.25 the high, the low at 212, settlement price at 212, and that finished up 0.25 as well. September contract in the corn pit, 220.5 the high, the low at 219.5, settled 219.5 up 0.25. And the December corn, 230 the high, the low at 229, settled 229.25 up 0.5. March futures, 237.5 the high, the low at 236.25, and a settlement price at 236.25. And that March corn contract for 2006 finished the day unchanged. Before we get to the oat and soybean numbers, a couple quick things coming up out of the closing market report. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. And then a fairly important story, I think, out of Washington, D.C. that you'll hear Dave Dickey report on during the newscast. And that, President Bush and the Bush administration is looking like for the 2006 budget year. Now, this is before any of the farm bill things will be opened up, but these are items that the Bush administration can change, at least the USDA Secretary of Agriculture, that'd be Mike Johanns now, can change if they'd like to. And they're going to take about $15 billion out of the farm programs over the next 10 years. They're going to start doing that, if the Bush administration budget is correct, and what we're hearing about it, by lowering both the commodity loan rates and the target prices. So we can take a look at that during the closing market report. Dave Dickey will have all the details. March oats for the day, 169.75 the high, the low at 167.75. In a settlement price at $1.68, they were up 0.75 for the day. May futures, $1.61.75 the high, the low at $1.60, settlement price $1.60.75, up 0.25 for the day. March soybeans now, new contract lows here, 5.18.25 the high, the low at 5.06, settlement price a penny above that at $5.07, down 7.75. May soybeans, 5.16.75 the high, the low at 5.06, settlement price there 5.07 as well, down 5.5 cents. And the July futures, 5.22 the high, the low at 12.5, and a settlement price at $5.13. They were down 4.5. August futures, 5.24 the high, the low at 5.17. The August, the only contract here not making a new low, It finished at 517, down 3. September futures, 527.5, the high, the low at $5.18, settled at 519, down 3. And the November futures were off 4 cents. Their settlement price for the new crop at $5.27 a bushel, with a high of 536, the low at 526, and that's a new contract low. January soybeans for next year, 539.5, the high, the low at 532, settlement price on that low at $5.32. They were off a nickel for the day. March bean meal, 155.30, the high, the low at 152.50, settled 152.70, down 110. And the May contract, 154.60, the high, the low at 152.20, settlement price at 152.40. They were down 60 for the day. March bean oil, 19.43, the high, the low at 19.02, settled $19.04, down 32 cents. And the May bean oil, 19.57, the high, the low at $19.20, settled 19.21, off 29. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today for lean hogs and February bellies, although feeder cattle and live cattle largely higher today. March feeder cattle, the high today, $101.20, the low $100.50, the settlement $100.92.5, that up 40. April, $100.85, the high $99.90, the low $100.75, the settlement that up 47.5. May, $100.05, the high $99.30, the low $100.02.5, the settlement that up 47.5. February live cattle, $90.92.5, the high $90.10, the low, the settlement $90.77.5, that up 55. April live cattle, $88.70, the high $88.00, the low $88.50, the settlement that up 17.5. February lean hog, $73.75, the high $73.07.5, the low, the settlement $73.62.5, that down 15. April $75.35, the high $74.60, the low, the settlement $75.12.5, that down 42.5. May $75.97.5, the high $75.35, the low $75.97.5, the settlement that off 25 cents. June lean hog $78.05, the high $77.52.5, the low, finishing at $77.97.5, down 37.5. February pork bellies, $93.90, the high today, the low $93.42.5, the settlement $93.80, that down 20. The Dow is up 61 points at 10,551, the NASDAQ 6 higher at 2068, and the S&P 500 up 7 points at 1189.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you.